This is the podcast for Monday, October 10th, 2011, Ethics. So we have a test coming up, and the test is going to open after class on Wednesday at 3:30, and it will close the following Wednesday, October 19th, at 7 p.m. when the lab closes here on the main campus. So just to repeat, test opens Wednesday, 3:30, October 12th, that's this Wednesday, and you'll have until the following Wednesday, October 19th, to complete it. If you take it on the last class day, you'll have to get there by 6 o'clock because you have to arrive 1 hour before closing. Also remember that any day you take the exam, you have to get there an hour before they close. So here on the main campus, the labs close at 7, which means you have to get there by 6 if you want to take it that day. And College Grove, hours vary, I'd say contact them. Details on testing, all in the syllabus. Just to remind you, you get a 3x5 card notes. There's a study guide in Moodle you should look over. And there's also a practice quiz in week 3. I've gotten all the topics up for this week, which is the last of the material for the first midterm exam. It's on divine command theory. And so the test will cover chapters 1 through 4, everything in the first 3 weeks of class, so everything up to and including Wednesday's class. And then you'll have a week to take the exam. Any questions?
Yeah. Primarily true or false essay?
Multiple choice, true or false. Taken in the testing lab, center 456, top of the stone steps right across from the English department, also known as Language, Literature, and Communication, but not a limited liability corporation. So I don't know why that was called the English department. I think the speech people, you know, were tired of people looking for the speech department or something. But maybe they didn't feel included. So Language, Literature, and Communication is inclusive.
Is there a number for it? Is there a door number?
Oh, center 456.
Thank you.
456. And there's details. If you click on in Moodle, a computer testing lab, you can get the hours and everything there. I don't know if I put them in the syllabus because sometimes they change. And they don't let me know. It isn't open until the third week, so. And sometimes it's just, you know, I don't know what they are a week or two before classes start when I'm doing my syllabus. Okay, so see if there's anything else left on moral skepticism that people want to talk about. Let me just say a couple of things about the forum posts first. So the first thing is when you're answering a forum post, don't tell other students stuff they already know. Like, I noticed with the Gyges Ring post, people are saying, well, in the story of Gyges Ring, there's this guy named Gyges, see? And he finds this ring. Like, people are supposed to have read that. So what you want to say is something like, I think that Gyges Ring shows the fact that human beings are self-interested creatures and will always do what's best for them. And that might not be what's best for somebody else. And I think that Gyges made me really think about why people act morally. And his theory is that, you know, Gyges thinks that the only reason you act morally is because you're afraid of being punished. But what do you do when you think you can get away with it? Well, it seems like if you're going to be rational, you'll do what you can get away with, even though it's wrong or unjust. And sort of talk about what it means, not like the facts. Because the facts should be things that people are aware of. And you might say something like, well, I really think that Gyges really doesn't take into account guilt feelings people have when they do something wrong. And most people feel guilty when they do things which go against society's rules. So maybe that's why you would have a reason to be moral. Gyges makes it seem like people can go out and commit acts of harm other people and, you know, sleep soundly at night. And maybe that's not true. So, you know, come up with a suggestion, an objection, a comment of some kind, which addresses the topic, but doesn't just regurgitate what's in the reading. So that's what I'm looking for. Also, I've told people this before, but stick with the fonts and the formatting of Moodle, just because it's easy to read, it's standardized, and it's, you know, people like me, they're wearing the graduated lenses and stuff like that, have a hard time when you shrink up the font, or you do it in, like, Courier, which is... I'm staring at this.
That was annoying. That was really annoying. Yeah. I saw through the form post that there's all these individual fonts.
So just go in and if you paste, if you're using your browser and you use paste and match style, that should give you the same style in Moodle. And, you know, avoid, when you're doing this, I'd again recommend doing this in a word processor. And then just, you can either save as plain text or you can paste and match style. That's so you can, if you use the mouse and the edit command, and right next to paste in your browser, you should get something that says paste and match style. Or if you just save it as a plain text or a TXT file, you know, just block paragraphs, don't indent, don't use special characters. And then if you want to jazz it up in Moodle with some bold or some italicized word you want to emphasize, do that in Moodle. And then submit it. And you can always edit afterwards too. Always make sure when you look at your post again, like after you post it, make sure it turned out okay. And above all, like make sure it's not filled with like obnoxious Microsoft Word formatting characters where it starts out with, you know, exclamation point 23J47 bracket, you know, because that looks really unsightly. So it's kind of a it's distracting. Okay, and make sure to post above all before Sunday night, 11:55 p.m. or you don't get credit.
Just to write it 11:50.
Yeah, and don't, like, if you're pressing that button 11:54, you get a connection error or something like that, you're going to be out of luck, so, you know. Start a little bit earlier than that. And I'm almost done marking all the posts. I got an earlier start on this last week, so I should have this done within the next couple of days. But the first week's posting has just been tough to get around to because I have this transit conference that I went to this weekend. If anybody is interested in media or writing or screenwriting or animation or any of that stuff, I got some recordings if you're interested. Just send me a little message and I can hook you up with those. It was a great conference. I think I forgot to mention it in class here. So they publicized it, I think, to a certain degree. But anyhow. Speaking of events, this Thursday at 5:30, Juliana Hammer is going to be here. She'll be speaking on Islam and women's rights. And it's something like, you know, do women's rights have a prayer in the Middle East or something like that. So she's, I believe, a progressive Muslim and talking about gender equality and feminism from a Muslim perspective and what's going on in the Middle East and what Islam's view is on women's rights. And so that will be this Thursday at 5:30 in the Center for Media and Learning, which is down that way. It's going to be like that big room next to the spiral staircase where they do all the big events. And then she's also going to be speaking to my Religions of the Middle East class, which is going to be on Thursday from 1 to 2:50. And so if you're interested in that, I'll post this on Moodle too. That's going to be in the Center for Media and Learning too. I think it's Building 19, Room 226 by memory. But I'll post that for my religion class if anyone here is interested, just show up. And that'll be from 1 to 2:50 on Thursday also. So if you can't make the evening thing, you can make the afternoon thing. And this actually will fit right in with what we're talking about today, which is about divine command theory, right? So if you're a Muslim and you take your religion seriously and you're reading Surah 4 and it says, men are the managers of the affairs of women. Those who you fear are disobedient, banish them to their couches and beat them, right? You're like, okay, well, if I want to know what the proper role between men and women is and how this all works, I've got a book written by God, given to the angel Gabriel, and then goes from the angel Gabriel to Muhammad, and then from Muhammad to the scribes, and then Muhammad checks it and says it's good, and then that's why I've got God's word here. And God's word says, if my wife isn't listening to me, I should send her to a room and give her a spanking, like a little kid or something like that. I'm like, okay, well, I guess that's how it is, and if my wife gives me some back talk or it was not listening to what I say, she's not obeying me, I need to administer some corporal punishment and send her to her room and keep her in line. And so that I don't think about, okay, well, what would be fair, just, and equitable? I think about, well, what did God say? And if I look around the people around me and I see that they have like these egalitarian relationships where like couples get together and like talk and communicate and decide, you know, jointly what the best course of action is or what they ought to do, and you know, and the woman in the relationship actually can drive an automobile and doesn't have to walk three steps behind her husband and so on. I think, well, that's kind of weird, but here's what God said this, so I'm going to do this. And those people are unbelievers, and so they're doing it the wrong way. Whereas as if you approach ethics from in terms of thinking about either what makes people happy or what's, you know, fair, what preserves human dignity, how you would like to be treated if you were a woman, if God forbid, right? If you're a woman, would you like want to be treated in that fashion? So, I mean, there are all sorts of other considerations that come into it where you can make it the decision based on sort of ethical concepts independent of religion. So then the question is, what is there some way of sort of combining the two? Or are these totally separate things? And can you really have it? And can you really have ethics without religion or without God? You know, what if ethics isn't based on the commandments of an ultimate being, what is it based on? Is it just all subjective? Is it emotions? Is it society? And so we'll be talking about that later on today. So just to finish off with moral skepticism. So I posed a lot of skeptical questions last time, and I think if I didn't hear the usual objections, and sometimes you get these sort of objections. Maybe I was pushing the case too hard. So the idea is, and I got some of these in the forum. So Glaucon's challenge again is, here's the way he says it. Okay, most people say justice is good and injustice is bad. But I'm here to tell you that injustice is good and justice is bad. And he says, why do you be just? Well, it's because you want everybody else to think you're an honest, trustworthy, good guy. But in the meantime, and then when you're making friends, you want other people that are honest and trustworthy. But people want to want to do what's good for them. And so you're playing this game where you put on a false face, and then if you have the opportunity, you're going to stab your best friend in the back and take all his stuff, and you know, his wife, and his money, and try to get power and control of the people. And that's sort of the way Falcon thinks about life, and that if you had no fear of punishment, you basically act like a, maybe not like a psychopath, like a drooling psychopath who's going around looking for, you know, mate to cause mayhem, but you wouldn't behave towards other people as if they had rights. You would behave towards other people as if they were objects for your own ends. And so, and a lot of people were talking about the kind of the psychological issues or the social issues. Would I do this given my background, or and kind of using it as a tool for introspection, where I want you to really focus on the rational, philosophical issues. If you wouldn't use Gaiji's ring to get money, sex, and power, or whatever else is good in life that you can't get now, you know, why would you worry about other people? So I mean, that's the question that Glaucon asks. And is justice really to your advantage, or is it sort of a necessary evil? So any thoughts on any of those things? Is injustice really better, and whatever they secretly want, but they behave justly to stay out of jail so their friends won't diss them, so they won't end up being beat to death by an angry mob? Yes?
Well, I think the punishments for injustice are a good thing, because the people who create the injustices, you know, receive the punishment, and everyone else sees that and makes them think twice. So I think, you know, obviously there's always going to be unjust people, and people are going to say they want justice but act differently. But having the punishments for injustice is good because, you know, people won't do crimes as often.
Right, so justice might be good for society, but bad for the individual. And Glaucon portrays it as a kind of a compromise. And this is sort of, you see the glimmering of like the social contract theory, where he says, okay, you have all these people that want to take other people's stuff and assault people they're angry with and have sex with their wives and sort of do all these things that they would like to do, but they're worried about payback. And so what happens is every individual, they try to get as much as they can out of life and from other people without pissing those other people off so much that it turns out badly for them. So it's this kind of game you play where you're trying to get the most out of life and you're respecting other people's rights insofar as you don't think it's going to come back on you. Yeah.
I'm curious why... I'll try to say this in a coherent way. Why is it considered rational for Glaucon to consider it rational to have such a fragmented personality where he has to hide all parts of him and he can't really be who he appears to be? Why is that supposedly rational to live in that fractured way? You can never really be honest. That's rational?
Well, here's a story. So I think about this. So what's rational? What's rational is to try to achieve your goal. So, for example, when I was in graduate school, there was this really hot babe that I wanted to get with, and she was like a Wiccan. And she was telling me the story about her, like, you know, coven convention or whatever they had out in the desert or something, and how a weatherwitch ceremony averted a tornado and, like, sent it off in the other direction. And I expressed, you know, skepticism with I might have smirked a little bit, and that basically like ended my chance of achieving my goal. Whereas if I and my other two friends, who are both extreme skeptics and physics geeks, both actually had short-term relationships with her. And so my problem was I was like honest and I had integrity and I was thinking about the larger philosophical issues instead of my like concrete immediate narrow goal. And so if I were to be like Glaucon, what I would do is I would say, oh, that's very interesting. And I'd be like, wow, you know, I'd like to learn more about Wicca, right? Because what's my goal? My goal is relations with this beautiful woman, right? And so, and I think that you might say that was rational. And if you were to ask me, like, you know, if I had a thought in retrospect, that's kind of my default position, is to think about like truth and, you know, and the sort of larger principles. But that's because I'm a philosopher. So, but maybe being a philosopher is not good, right? Look where I got Socrates, Hemlock, right? So my other two friends, which we were less philosophical, more pragmatic, more like Glaucon, they both achieved their goal, whereas I didn't. And so it's not like you have to be false all the time, but it's like, you know, your wife says, does this dress make you look fat? And you say, honey, every dress makes you look fat, because you're fat, right? You don't want to say that, you're going to get into trouble, you're going to be in the doghouse. So the idea is you kind of, you know, but then, you know, if you're around your friends and you're talking about some trivia, it's not like you have to lie all the time. Or it's not like you have to sort of pretend all the time. You only pretend in cases where it's to your advantage to kind of massage the truth or to kind of not tell somebody something that you know they want to know, but which would be bad for you if they knew. It's like, you know, think about, you know, you're a little late for work or for school, and you're on the freeway, and the speed limit says 65. Do you ever drive, like, 70? Maybe you drive 70 all the time. Maybe you drive 75 all the time. But what do you do when you see that state trooper there on parked by the side of the road? Ooh, he's off the accelerator, right? Why? Because you're worried about getting caught. So the idea is that when you're doing your day-to-day life, people do this all the time. They're like, okay, well, I want to do what I want, like, you know, get to school on time, get to work on time. I don't like driving slower than I have to, but I don't want to get a ticket, so I kind of ease off the accelerator a little bit when I see that cop. Or maybe I don't drive as fast as I might, and I drive a little slower just in general because I'm worried about a ticket. Yeah.
Do you think there might be a different definition of rational besides getting what you want or getting your goal?
Well, what's rational about, like, spending your time trying to achieve other people's goals? Like doing things that you don't really particularly have a care about one way or another, but spending all your time trying to satisfy other people's desires. Like, you know, like a stereotypical Jewish mother, right? Who's focused on her kid. And then her kid turns out to be a huge disappointment, and then where's she at, you know? She's like, she nags for years and years and years and tries to get him to be a doctor and a lawyer, and he ends up like a, you know, community college professor at a, you know, doing philosophy instead of doing something respectable. Right? And she's disappointed. Or just think about all the different, you know, I don't know, somebody else think of an example of what why would you spend your time trying to make other people happy instead of your, making yourself happy? That, I mean, that seems kind of irrational when you think about it. Now, some people, they get happy making other people happy, I guess, but if you can do both, I guess that's good, right? If you can make yourself happy making other people happy, then other people are going to like you and you'll have a good reputation. But maybe it comes back to self-interest again. We'll talk about, like, psychological egos and this idea that maybe all actions are self-interested. Yeah.
Let me just give you one final example. Let's say I want a degree in mathematics.
Okay, sorry.
And I don't have that.
A little louder, please.
Let's say I want a degree in high math.
Okay, right.
Degree and I don't have the ability to understand string theory. But I can get ghostwriters and stuff to do that for me, and I have achieved my goal of having a piece of paper that says I have a degree in mathematics that would make people assume I understand that stuff. Functionally, I haven't got a clue how to do it, but I've achieved the goal of having something that deceived people, but it's worthless.
Uh-huh.
Now, that doesn't seem rational to me.
Well, think about, like, you know, John F. Kennedy wrote this book, Profiles in Courage, right? Everybody thinks it's a guy that did a winner Pulitzer or something like that. But he didn't really write that book. Now, how many people here knew that you know, some ghostwriter actually wrote Profiles in Courage, and that Kennedy sort of had, you know, he kind of gave an outline of what he wanted written, but he didn't really write that book. Anybody know that? Yeah, one person, yeah. So most people think Kennedy's like this great guy. He's this iconic figure who's admired by people. Very few people know that, you know, he did. Think about, okay, Martin Luther King. How many people know that Martin Luther King was like a plagiarist? That he plagiarized his dissertation at Boston University. Anybody? Nobody knows that. Everybody knows, okay, one person. Everybody knows Martin Luther King is like a great civil rights leader. Nobody knows he plagiarized his dissertation from another graduate student at Boston University. So even like people that we regard as moral icons, they kind of cut corners and they do things behind the scenes that get them ahead in life. Now, did that come back to, you know, to haunt him or create a big problem for him? Well, no, I guess because, you know, nobody was interested in investigating him, or nobody found out until he'd been dead for a while, and nobody cares today because his achievements overshadow what he did in the past. The adultery thing probably maybe a little more well known, but I mean, how many people here knew that Martin Luther King Jr. was an adulterer? Okay, more people, right? But you know, how many people care? So maybe it's a little blight, but you think about all the pleasure he got about all these women that he'd be with from, you know, and the fancy hotels and knocking back, you know, the high-priced liquor and having these liaisons with these women. I mean, that's pretty fun, right? So he got to be a moral icon, a man of the cloth, a minister, and also have enjoy the pleasures of the flesh. And have a degree from Boston University with a little help from another graduate student that helped him in his dissertation with Paul Taylor. And, you know, it seems like he came out ahead doing all those things. And that advances rational self-interest. So, I mean, that's the thing where you have to say, well, why should you care about other people? Or why should you care about something like integrity when, you know, other strategies will get you farther towards your goals? It's like once you can fake integrity, the rest is easy. So that's Glaucon's challenge. And I suppose one answer to that is God, right? if there is a God and if he has moral commandments, you know, Martin Luther King didn't really get away with Martin Luther King Jr. didn't get away with those liaisons with women who are not his wife, with maybe misusing funds from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference for expensive hotels and high-priced liquor, and plagiarizing his dissertation, because when he comes before the great white throne of God, God's going to say, okay, Martin, you did some good stuff. You had the civil rights movement, and there was that great I Have a Dream speech, and you advanced the rights for people of color. Good job. But there are these other things I want to talk to you about, right? I mean, maybe he's going to get a dressing down before God, and there's going to be some sort of, payback. Or maybe he's just going to feel guilty and shameful for it. Now, in Christianity, you can be forgiven for those things. So, and nobody knows, you know, whether he was, you know, repentant for those things. But in Christian theology, to sort of add a wrinkle to things, you can always ask forgiveness. That's a sort of another thing where a cynical person might say, well, you know, sin it up and then get forgiven later. And that's actually the great theologian Saint Augustine has this famous prayer where he prayed to God, "Oh Lord, give me repentance, but not yet," because when he was a young man, he really enjoyed money, politics, philosophy, and sex with the women he was married to. And it was only until he got to be about the age of 40. That he started getting more spiritual. And there, you know, the drives aren't as strong, and you're kind of slowing down a little bit, getting more philosophical. And that's the time to be a philosopher when you're 40, not when you're 20. And that's the time to get religion, when you're, you know, after you sowed all those wild oats and have some great stories to tell about it, and really enjoyed yourself. And then you can, like, be sorry, oh, I guess I shouldn't have done that. And then you get forgiven, and then you're, you know, as long as you don't, you know, get hit by a bus when you're 25, you might be okay. So that's this idea of if you think about divine command theory, one reason why it might seem attractive is it says that, it's an answer to Glaucon's challenge. So let's leave the repent later thing alone for a minute, but just think. So the question is that Glaucon poses, or the skeptic. Why be moral when you can get away? Why be moral when you can get away with being immoral? What's divine command theory have to sort of solve this problem? Why be moral? What are you going to say if you're a person of faith? When someone says, well, why should I follow these silly moral rules? I want to get what's good for me. And that means taking what I want and not worrying about who I have to step on to get it.
You don't want to help.
Yeah, you're going to be punished. So you... you can't get away with it. God will punish you if society doesn't. So this is like a really good thing, because you look at the example of like, okay, what if I'm sleeking around looking for something to steal. Ooh, it's a $200 calculus book. I bet I could get $150 for this on eBay. I just slip into my pack and walk out of the restroom. And too bad for the sucker that left it there. Or even, I might just do the bump and grab or something like that, right? There's all kinds of ways of, some people might say, well, if you leave something laying around that it's, you get what you deserve. But I might even actually lift a book out of somebody's backpack. Or I might just walk by and grab it off the table as I'm passing by. I see a person maybe who's like in a really intense conversation in the cafeteria. Maybe they're breaking up with their girlfriend, it looks like. And the girlfriend's crying. It's like, but honey, I love you. Just come by there. You see that book, the Introduction to Calcius. Just kind of put it in the bag, keep walking, right? It's like $150, right? So, but then nobody will see me. What's that?
Did you actually do this?
No.
Seems like you have a lot of situational.
Now, if I'd really done it, would I admit to it in front of class? Of course I wouldn't. So the thing is, like, what if I say I'd never get caught? But the thing is, I would always get caught, right? Because I'm going to be before God's great white throne. He's like, you remember that commandment where I said, no stealing? Well, you stole that $150 Calcius book and... because of that boy, had a nervous breakdown and had dropped out of school because he, after breaking up with his girlfriend, he went to do his Calculus homework and math was his life. He wanted to be a math professor and he ended up like as a street thug or whatever.
Street thug professor.
So he wrote equations on the wall of the rubber room he got put in. Or whatever, right? Or maybe just, you should have stole that book, that was wrong. Right? And then God, I'm going to get some kind of punishment, maybe. Or if you believe in, like, so there's like this kind of the Eastern version where it's something like karma. Right? That whatever karma is sort of the law, it's called the law of action. Or sometimes the law of consequences literally means the law of action. And the idea is that every action has consequences. And there isn't like an intentional agent, like a God who's looking around and sees what you do and is angry with you and then sends you some punishment. Or when you die, doles out punishment like a father disciplining a child. It's more like a kind of action-reaction, like of the laws of physics. And just like there are the laws of physics that says for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction, there are the laws of the spiritual laws of physics, or the laws of karma, which say that if you do something wrong, it's going to come back in you in some way. So how about this? Is this going to be a solution to a problem? What do you think? It's a good answer to the skeptic. What, is this karma thing, is this really true? Is this supported by empirical evidence? Yeah.
I think you kind of almost make it true to yourself when you do something bad and then things start to go wrong in threes, like that's the thing. I'm late to work this morning and it must have been because yesterday I tripped this little kid. You just make it true in your mind if you believe in karma like that.
But isn't that like, that's what in critical thinking they call confirmation bias, right? Where if you expect something bad to happen to you when you do something bad, you're going to interpret any bad thing as being causally related to the other thing. Is there really a relationship? I mean, how would you even know? It seems like there are lots of times where you do something bad and nothing happens. And what, 3 years later, you get the cancer or you get in a car accident and you're like, oh, this is punishment for stealing that Calculus book back at Lincoln Community College. I mean, it seems like a kind of a tenuous connection, right? Maybe the reason you got in that car wreck is just because, that illegal alien drank too much tequila and T-boned you at that intersection because he was drunk and he didn't know how to drive or read the street signs or whatever. I mean, that it doesn't necessarily have to be a bigger picture, like that was punishment. Yeah.
I think the fact that we associate two acts like that is a form of guilt. It's our feeling that, oh, we're atoning for this bad thing we've done, so we have to associate it with something bad that happens to us.
Yeah, know, my ex-wife would live like this. She would do something really stupid or foolish and then say, God's punishing me. Right? I'm like, no, God's not punishing me. You didn't show up for work and you got fired for your job. That's why you got fired. God has nothing to do with it. But for her, she felt bad about it, but she didn't want to take personal responsibility and was seemingly unaware of the fact that if you call in sick too many times, people start to think you're not really sick, and then they fire you from the job. But her, because she had this upbringing where her grandmother would tell her she would go to hell if she didn't make her bed in the morning, she has this sort of stuck in her mind that, oh, if I do something bad, God's going to punish me. And then whenever anything bad would happen to her, she'd think, oh, God's punishing me. But it wasn't really true. So, and see, doesn't it seem like there are a lot of bad people that seem to go through life without, you know, bad things happening to them? It's like the book of Ecclesiastes, even the Bible talks about this, right? I've seen the righteous man, I've seen the wicked man prospering in his wickedness and the righteous man perishing in his righteousness. Socrates, Jesus, all the martyrs. Fox's Book of Martyrs is full of people who lived for God and were killed in excruciating ways, drawn and quartered, tortured to death. Just all sorts of horrible things that were done to people. Why? Because of their faith. Because they were true to their convictions. Because they wouldn't renounce their faith. Because they wouldn't kowtow to what the religious authorities said they should believe, but what were more were sort of true to their own faith, and not what the religious authorities said it should be. So how about? So this is an advantage, right? So it seems that this is a way around the moral skeptic, because you're always going to get what you deserve if there is justice in the universe, if there's a God, if there's a sort of cosmic order. But then the question, I suppose, is there such a thing? Maybe we'll get to that in a minute. How about, what else? What about like a basis of morality? That seems... Remember we talked about the sort of idea that there's, don't steal and don't lie and, this idea of rights and charity and being a good friend. And keep your promises. All these parts of sort of what you might call conventional or common sense morality that's cross-cultural that people believe in. But then the question is, what does that apply to? Right? So if you have like a statement like, the cat is on the map, right? You look at the cat is on the map. And then you say, well, what does that refer to? Well, it refers to the cat and it refers to the map, and it specifies a relationship between the two. And so we look out there in the world and we see the map and then we see the cat. And if the cat is on the map, then it's true. Easy, right? But when you have something like, well, you should keep your promises, what's the reality we can look at that tells us whether we should do that or not, whether that's true? Or take, the thornier things like the state shouldn't execute people, or that the government should control the economy, or you should steal money from rich people and give it to poor people, or whatever it is, things that people believe are morally right or morally wrong. War is always wrong, or whatever, right? Oh, we have all these moral beliefs, but what are they referring to? Well, the great thing about divine command theory is we can put something in here. God's commands. And so we can look at these moral beliefs and see if they're in accord with commands of God. And if they are, then they're true. If they're not, then they're false. And so this is like a way of solving the problem of what do moral statements refer to? They refer to the commands of God. Or sometimes people will say, well, they don't, even if God doesn't, like, if we don't have a revelation of God's commands, we can think about God as being sort of the moral lawgiver that justifies all of our moral beliefs. So what do you think about this as a solution to the why be moral problem? Any thoughts? Yes, sir.
It's an okay solution depending upon what you think those commands are. Like the woman who's going to speak, she might talk about the actress who got sentenced to Iran, in Iran just the other day, or what's going on in Egypt right now. So it can be a bad thing.
So while he's doing that for a minute, and we can talk about maybe a problem about how religion and morality are related to each other, and we'll come back to this question about whether this is a good way of thinking about ethics. So there's one problem about saying that ethics depend on God or religion, and that's what's called the Euthyphro problem. And this starts out, it's introduced in one of Plato's dialogues called the Euthyphro. Euthyphro is a friend of Socrates. This is Socrates, this occurs when Socrates is on trial for his life before the city of Athens, the city-state of Athens. And he meets his friend Euthyphro on the court steps, and they're both waiting to hear their cases. So if you ever got pulled for jury duty, right, there's a lot of standing around time. And if you're, you know, you're waiting for your case, if you've ever been to traffic court, right, there's a lot of waiting around before your case is called. So people just sort of hang out on the steps before, like, a person would come out and say, okay, Socrates, you're up, right? So they're just hanging out there, and so, and they're talking about what else, their cases, right? It's like, you know, you end up in jail. Hey, what are you in for, right? So you're hanging out on the courthouse steps. Oh, so what's your case about? And Euthyphro says, well, let me tell you why I'm here. I'm prosecuting my own father for murder. And Socrates says, wow, that's pretty astounding. You're prosecuting your own father? And the Euthyphro says, yeah, let me tell you what happened. So so my father has, like, this, you know, like a farm. And he's got these two people, two servants that work for him. And they got into a fight. And one guy killed the other guy. So servant A killed servant B. Servant B, my father, threw into a ditch. He, like, tied him up and threw him into a ditch and said, I'm going to let you stew there and think about what you did while I send out a runner to the Oracle of Delphi to find out what I should do about you. So this father, you think, well, he's, you know, he is going to punish the evildoer. He wants to punish him appropriately, and so he's doing his religious duty by sending a messenger out to the Oracle of Delphi to find out what he should do. The Oracle of Delphi is this the priestess of Apollo at the temple at Delphi would speak under the inspiration of Apollo, kind of channel the god Apollo and dispense advice to people. Perhaps under the influence of natural gas seeps, which would give her dreams and visions. Probably gazing into, like, a pool of water where she would see things. Anyway, so while he's waiting for the messenger to come back, the murdering servant, dies of exposure because he's been left in the, you know, ditch. No food or water, exposed to the elements, the cold of the night, he dies. Oops. So now Euthyphro finds out about this and finds out his father's killed the servant, and he's a man of principle. And he says, justice means prosecuting somebody for murder no matter who it is, whether it's even your own father. And it doesn't matter who the victim is, whether he's a person of prominence or a person, you know, the lowliest of servants. And it doesn't matter whether that servant is himself a murderer or not, because everybody has rights. That's sort of the sort of highfalutin principled stance that Euthyphro is taking. This sort of idea of absolute justice, right? That everybody has rights, that that no one is above the law and or below the law, and so he's going to prosecute his own father for accidentally killing a slave. So basically for manslaughter. A slave who himself is a murderer. And Socrates basically says, wow, that's that you must really know all about morality then, and particularly about religious morality, because remember there's this area of the sort of the gods and this wanting to do his religious duty by sending the messenger out. You must really know all about, and he uses this word, piety or holiness. It really could be described as religious morality. And Euthyphro says, well, why? Well, yes, I do. And then they start this discussion. And so there's this question that comes up as they discuss. First, Socrates says, well, I wonder if you could tell me what this piety or holiness is. Is there anybody remember what does Euthyphro say? Like, what's his first response when he's asked for a definition of piety? Remember? Or holiness. I can't remember. What's our translation? Is it holiness or piety?
Piety.
Piety, okay. The translation vary. I can remember off the top of my head which translation I gave you. It's a Jowett. Jowett likes piety. So, I mean, he starts out, he's asked for a definition. He says, well, it's just what I'm doing right now, prosecuting my own father for murder. And Socrates says, well, you know, that's not really what I'm looking for. I'm looking for a definition. He kind of gives some explanation of what he means by definition. And a definition of piety, he's looking for something which will give both the necessary and sufficient conditions for an action to be pious. So necessary and sufficient conditions.
Page 62?
Yeah.
So he wants something which will define piety such that all and only those things which are pious will fit the definition. In other words, there's no pious action that won't fit the definition, and there isn't something that fits the definition which isn't pious. So all the things that he wants to know, all those things that you need to be pious, and all those things which, you know, are enough to make an action pious. And doesn't want anything put in there that isn't like absolutely necessary to be pious. So, for an example, so like in this case of his father, like it's not really a necessary condition of something being pious that involves your father, right? Some pious actions involve fathers and relationship with fathers, and some don't. The fact that it involves a slave isn't really part of being pious. He's looking for like a distillation of what the essence of piety is. And he thinks if you get the essence of what something is, that's really its definition. All and only those things which are pious. And so finally Euthyphro gets to a definition, and he says, well, piety is, and what's his first definition, the first real definition? What the gods love. Right, piety is what the gods love. So if the gods love a thing, that makes it pious. And Socrates says, well, you know, as I think about this, it seems like there might be a problem with this definition, because it seems like the gods love and hate different things. Zeus seems to love adultery. Hera hates adultery. Right? Ares loves war. Aphrodite loves love. Hephaestus loves smithing, right?
Yeah, building,
making stuff. And maybe, you know, Asclepius doesn't really give a hoot about, you know, horseshoes and swords and metal implements, right? But he really cares about healing. But maybe Hephaestus doesn't really care about healing. So all these different gods have their specialties and their likes and dislikes, right? Athena loves the city of Athens.
Poseidon.
What's that?
Poseidon.
Poseidon.
Mars.
Poseidon loves sailors or whatever, right? And you have, and Ares loves soldiers. So you have all these different gods that seem to love and hate different things, and they're portrayed in Greek mythology as constantly in conflict with one another. And each, you know, each of the Greek city-states have their patron gods and goddesses, and they, when they're at war, you know, their gods were in their corner. So, Euthyphro says, okay, well, I'm going to modify the definition. Piety is what all the gods love. Okay, so that solved that problem. So areas of controversy, they don't count. We're going to throw all those out. If the gods aren't unanimous on loving a certain thing, we're not going to call it pious or holy. So so you're not going to get the same action being both pious and impious. That's good. That doesn't make any sense. So all those things that the god, that all the gods love, those things are pious. And then he asks this question. Are things pious? Let's see. Let's see this right thing. Is a thing pious because the gods love it? Or do the gods love it because it's pious? Do the gods love things because they're pious? Put it this way. Do the gods love things because they're pious, or are things pious simply because the gods love them? Are things pious simply because the gods love them? Okay, so there's two alternatives. The first is the gods love things because they're pious. Well, what would be an example of this? What would be an example of one of the gods loving a thing because it's pious, because it's sort of religiously observant or religiously good? Think about like sacrifice, for example. Gods love their sacrifices. And let's suppose that's one of the examples, right? That, okay, what all the gods love? Well, all the gods love to have sacrifices. So, you know, animal sacrifices were part of Greek religion. So the question is, do the gods love sacrifice because it's pious? Well, if the gods love sacrifice because it's pious, then there's some quality in the nature of sacrifice that makes it pious, which causes the gods to love it, which is going to be independent of the gods loving it, right? Because you can't say, well, why do the gods love sacrifice? Well, because they love it. That doesn't make any sense. Gods love sacrifice for some reason. That reason is going to be what makes it pious, whether it's, you know, giving up something of value to yourself and showing your respect for the gods. Well, then piety is going to include respect. Piety is going to include giving up something which is of value to you, to the gods, right? So these are going to be different components of piety, which have nothing to do with whether the gods love it or not. The reason why the gods love pious actions is going to become what piety is. And the fact that they love it is just going to be incidental. So the second option, maybe, that's where we should go. So things are pious simply because the gods love them. So the idea here is that the gods really don't have any reason, but because all the gods happen to love sacrifice, sacrifice is pious. And that's just, by definition, sacrifice is pious because you ask the gods, who here approves a sacrifice? And if every god on Mount Olympus says, I do, then that means, well, sacrifice is pious. So that's, if we put this in the more Judeo-Christian terms, does God command things because they're right? Does God command things because they're right? Or are things right simply because God commands them. Does God command things because they're right? Or are things right simply because God commands them? So think about, suppose God commands against premarital sex. So God says, don't do it. So the question is, does God have a reason why he commands against premarital sex? And if so, what might that be? Hypothetically speaking. Why wouldn't God want you to enjoy yourself and have sex with lots of different partners? Yeah.
You might get a disease and die.
You might get a disease. I saw a statistic that showed something like, what's that number? There's some huge high number of college students. There's like 25% of college students had herpes virus or something. And you got the human papillomavirus. That was the vaccine for it. But the HPV is just the huge numbers of people carrying these things around. So you get the herpes where you get warts in your genitals, and you have the HPV virus. There's the AIDS, right? You're playing Russian roulette. You can use a condom, but there's still a chance of transmission even from using a condom if you're talking about the herpes virus.
There's like a 65% prevalence on one of them. I think it's HSV-1, and HSV-2 is like 25% prevalent.
Yeah, so like the genital version, like 25, yes. A quarter of the people in this room of like the age, I think it was like the study was like 18 to 49 or something like that, of those people have herpes. Now, not everybody has symptoms, and whether you get symptoms has to do with
asymptomatic,
your immune system. So that's a reason, right? How about unwanted pregnancies? Well, you get if you're a guy, if you get a girl pregnant and she brings the baby to term, you're looking at 18 years of monthly payments for that child. And it's good unless she remarries or something. And even then, I think you still got to pay something. And it's like you're paying every month. Or if you're a woman, you might have to face, all the complications of birth and the emotional trauma of adoption, or you have to deal with a fallout from an abortion, and just the horrible decisions to have to make, right? And the decisions can be avoided. And then there's also, you think about relationships. If you're hopping from bed to bed, and you're doing that as a habit for years, what are your prospects of entering into a monogamous relationship later in life? Might not be so good, right? It might be that if you're going from partner to partner and you sort of get used to this promiscuous lifestyle, the idea of settling down might not be appealing to you. And maybe you find this woman and you're like, you want her to only be with you, but after a while, the marriage, 2 or 3 years, you're starting to look at the other women again and you're like, oh, I'd like to be single again. And you can't have both, so... Anyway, so there are reasons, right? But then the question is, do I really need God to tell me that? In other words, if God's reason why I shouldn't have premarital sex is that I could get a disease, that I could have an unwanted pregnancy, and that I might have trouble with a monogamous relationship later on, those reasons will be what makes premarital sex wrong, independent of whether God commands against it or not. And so so then it doesn't really seem that morality depends on God says so. God actually has some reasons. So at best, God's going to be sort of a cosmic Dear Abby dispensing moral advice, but he's not going to be the ground of morality. Okay, then maybe we have to go the other way. Maybe we have to say things are right simply because God commands them. And God says it, and that's what you should do. But then there's the question with that is, well, doesn't that make morality seem kind of arbitrary? Because if God doesn't really have any reasons, it's just he says so, then anything could be right or wrong, right? God could command torturing babies for fun. That would be a moral duty. Now, some people would say, well, God would never command such a thing, right? Well, why not? Why wouldn't God command torturing babies for fun or murder, wanton murder, or those sorts of things? Yeah.
But if you read, if you've never read the Bible, it's all about like murder and battle and armies and stuff. So it's like not commanded.
Okay, well, that, I mean, that's another wrinkle I gave you, like those patches from the Old Testament, primarily that show this, you know, God commanding such things like wiping out the indigenous people, and stealing their land. And of course, you know, from God's point of view, it's all His land anyway, right? Punishing people for what their ancestors did and those sorts of things. And those, you know, we look at those today, and most people say that seems kind of unfair, but what you have to, if you subscribe to this second part, things are right because God commands them. Then, if God commands military conquest or genocide or human sacrifice, all of which can be found in the Bible, because God commands it, that makes it right. Now, if a human being did it without God's, you know, say so, then it would be wrong. But because God commands it, it's right because God commanded it. But some people would say, well, no, God would never command genocide. And they, you might say, well, it's because, why is that? Because God is good. But then what does that mean? What does it mean to say, if you try to say, okay, well, God would never command anything that would be wrong? I mean, it seems like if you say God would never command something wrong, you're looking at this. You're thinking that God has some reasons for what He does. If God has reasons, those reasons will be what makes things right or wrong, independent of what God says. But suppose you say, okay, well, God is good. What does that really mean? Does that mean God is just, kind, loving, you know, etc., all the qualities of goodness? Or does that mean that God has the nature God has, or something, right? God is, if you define goodness in terms of God's nature, then to say God is good is kind of a tautology. It's like saying water is wet or something, right? So if good has some content to it, like, you know, being just and kind and loving, then it's not going to fit in with like genocide and human sacrifice. If you say, well, whatever God's nature is, that's going to define goodness, then God could be cruel, and then cruelty would be good. God could be callous, and then callousness would be good. So as soon as you start to flesh out the content of what you mean by goodness in human terms, oh, well, you know, treating people fairly and justly and being kind and loving and forgiving and wanting people to be happy, then all of a sudden you have some content to the concept, which is independent of God's nature. So this is the form of, it's a dilemma argument, and it basically says that either way you cut it, religion and morality are going to be independent. So either God has reasons for His commandments, and those reasons are going to be what make things right and wrong, or God's commandments are arbitrary, in which case it doesn't make any sense either. And so you have to go back to morality being independent of God's commands. So what do you think about this dilemma? Counter-arguments? Objections? Yeah?
If you can't figure out what may be a motivation for God doing something or saying something would be, does that invalidate what He does?
Yeah, so you might, and there might be one thing you would do where you'd say, oh, well, maybe God has some morally sufficient reason for commanding genocide, I just don't know about it. And maybe someday He'll tell me or something.
Well, it's just like, I guess, back in the Old Testament, like the Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, the genocide thing, but yet He gave us free will to do whatever we wanted. So it's like, why did He destroy the whole city of people? He gave us free will, so it might be bad or whatever, but that was what they chose. But in God's eyes, it was wrong. But why wasn't it right as well?
Yeah, so Sodom and Gomorrah, God destroyed the whole city, instead of like doing the surgical strike and killing only the bad ones. But there weren't even 10 righteous people in the city, according to the story. So I guess they were all bad. And I think that the argument you get about like the genocide in the Old Testament is that, you know, most if not all of those people were bad. They were a corrupt culture. But you think about, you know, killing little babies and women. So in this, the accounts I give you, I mean, they killed every living thing in the city, including the animals, and they were burned to the ground. And then the valuables were put in God's treasury house. So it's, so they basically killed everything and took all the loot and stuck it in the temple treasury. I guess they didn't have a temple yet, but they had like a store of goods. Like they take the gold and silver and the jewelry, and that would go to God. Everybody got killed, and they burned all the cities to the ground. And then they took over. And you know, most people look at, say, what the settlers did to the Native Americans. Oh, that was terrible. But when God does a similar thing to the indigenous peoples of Canaan, they're like, well, it was God's will. And actually, people back in the settlers used to use this term manifest destiny, which is sort of like the sort of the thing the Israelites had about the people of Canaan. That these people were all cursed, they're descendants of Ham, and God cursed them, and God's given the land to us. No other thoughts? There was another thought I had before going to the genocide thing. What was the question I asked right before we started talking about the Old Testament passages? What was I mentioned something then. I forgot.
It was about the, if someone, we're talking about if God is good, why is God good? Is he, you know, and then we were saying something about murder, like if everyone can, or if someone could murder someone, then what would make it?
Yeah, maybe it's gone now. Anyway, if you look at those passages in the Old Testament, there you have God commanding things, and so some people would look at the things that God commands. Oh, and it's the morally sufficient reason, right? So some people would say, okay, well, it might look bad to us that God commands genocide, but God must have a reason. It's just that we can't know what that reason is. So what we need to do is like trust God and trust his revelation, and then and not rely on our own flawed, corrupt moral sensibilities. And we don't have all the information that God has. What do you think about that as a sort of an answer? Yeah.
I just think it's interesting that you're saying, you know, it's okay, you know, if God commands genocide, but at the same time they were collecting all the valuables and putting them in the temple. Like, after summoning them out, you know, he's basically saying, don't worry about your clothing, don't worry about eating, like, don't worry about the material. Just kind of contradictory, although I'm sure you can justify it, you know, if you say, well, it's okay with God.
I mean, it's a good point that Jesus' ethic seems very different than the Old Testament ethic in a lot of ways, in that Jesus says, you know, seek God's kingdom and, you know, be a peacemaker and love your enemies. It's kind of hard to love your enemies when you're ramming through with a short sword or taking their land or driving them out and burning their houses to the ground. Except for the, you know, collaborator. Like, there's Rahab the prostitute, who's seen as like a hero of the faith because she basically betrayed her city to the Israelites. And when they were trying to invade, she sort of she hid the spies that got sent out. So they sent some spies out for some recon work, and they hid out of her house, and she hid them, and then in exchange, her life was spared. Well, I mean, she was basically like the Benedict Arnold to the people of Jericho, right? She was a traitor, and she seemed there was a hero because she helped out the right side. She helped out God's side. And everybody else there was like slaughtered. But you look at what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, and it's, you know, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, and so on. Turn the other cheek. Blessed are the peacemakers. And there you get an ethic of unconditional love for all people, and helping the poor, a lot of things that people find inspiring and good. So I think that kind of shows you like the different mix of ideas. And I guess the question about, you know, how you sort of put those two together is a thorny issue in Christian theology that maybe we don't have time to go into. How about this? So it's not like there's just the Bible, right? You have the Old Testament. There's a lot of Jews out there who don't accept the New Testament. You have the Old and New Testament, the Bible that's widely accepted by Christians who are still the majority religion on the face of the planet. But then you got like over a billion Muslims, right? And they accept the Quran in addition to the Bible. And they're kind of... they're kind of iffy about parts of the New Testament, but they accept Jesus as a prophet, although not the Son of God. And they say that we have the Quran, which is perfect in every way. And the Bible, you got to kind of take it with a grain of salt. There's some parts of it that are correct. There's some parts of it that aren't quite right. But the Quran is God's perfect revelation. And then you have like the Mormons, right? The Mormons say, well, you got the Old and New Testament. Forget about the Quran. But then there's like Doctrines and Covenants, and there's the Book of Mormon, and the teachings of the living prophets, and those are an addition to the Bible. And the Bible's kind of got some problems with it, and so you can't really rely on it, but you can rely on the teachings that this latter-day revelation, the revelation of the Latter-day Saints. And then you got all these Hindus, right, that believe in like the 300 million gods who are really a manifestation of the one God, and there's like probably 800 million, 900 million, almost a billion Hindus. And then you got your Confucianists and your Taoists and Tao Te Ching, the ancient revered book of Taoism, the Analects of Confucius. Confucius is more kind of like, I suppose, a religious social philosopher or something. I don't know if he's... Confucianism is more of a philosophy than a religion to me. And then don't forget about Buddhism, right? A lot of Buddhists out there. So then the question is, which book do you go by if you're going to pick a revelation? How do you know which one? And when you compare your beliefs about religion to your most closely held moral beliefs, which are you more certain of? So is there a God? If so, has he given a revelation? If so, which revelation is truest to his intentions or is the perfect one? Or at least which one is closest to the truth? Are those things you're going to put up front? Or are you going to go with like, torturing babies for fun is wrong? I shouldn't go around harming people and taking their property. Which seems more certain to you? God exists. God's revelation is this particular book, or I shouldn't harm other human beings, or I shouldn't derive pleasure from the sufferings of others, or I should treat people fairly. Any thoughts on that? It seems like, yeah.
Obviously, it's easier to like base your actions on what you feel is right rather than justify if there is a God and which book is correct and which one you are going to base your feelings off of.
Yeah, it seems, and you say what you feel is right. I'm not sure I put it exactly like that, but you know, what you believe is right, maybe. So you have like beliefs about certain things being wrong, like torturing babies for fun is wrong. Is that belief more or less certain than God exists in your mind? Or God authored this particular book? Or think about, you know, is wrong to steal? Is that for most people, that's a pretty strong fundamental belief. Is that belief more or less certain than, X is a true religion? Or, you know, even God exists, if you think of... So one argument people have made is that, okay, even if there is a true religion and a true spiritual path, these moral beliefs still are more fundamental than speculative beliefs about religion or, you know, faith, which aren't based on evidence, but based on... religious beliefs not based on evidence, but based on faith. Whereas as your moral beliefs are something that are very visceral and self-evident. So it's self-evident to people that stealing is wrong, but it's not necessarily self-evident to people that there's a God or that this is a particular religion, because people will disagree on which God and which book or whether there is a God. But those same people aren't going to disagree on stealing is wrong. They might differ on some of the details, but not on sort of the basic principle that all other things being equal, it's bad to steal. So we'll do a little more on divine command theory, doing some reviewing for the exam, and I'll see you guys on Wednesday. Topics are up in the forum if you'd like to post early.